Welcome to Zoom Philadelphia, ULT. We are one of 24 centers around the world, and additionally, there are individuals and study groups scattered all over the place, all focusing on the study of the philosophy of theosophy and the exemplification of lessons learned. So in order to open up this morning's presentation, I'd like to read the Declaration of the United Lodge of Theosophists. The policy of this lodge is independent devotion to the cause of theosophy without professing attachment to any theosophical organization. It is loyal to the great founders of the theosophical movement, but does not concern itself with dissensions or differences of individual opinion. The work it has on hand and the end it keeps in view are too absorbing and too lofty to leave it the time or inclination to take part in side issues. That work and that end is the dissemination of the fundamental principles of the philosophy of theosophy and the exemplification in practice of those principles through a truer realization of the self, a profounder conviction of universal brotherhood. It holds that the unassailable basis for union among theosophists, wherever and however situated, is similarity of aim, purpose, and teaching, and therefore has neither constitution, bylaws, nor officers, the sole bond between its associates being that basis. And it aims to disseminate this idea among theosophists in the furtherance of unity. It regards as theosophists all who are engaged in the true service of humanity without distinction of race, creed, sex, condition, or organization. And it welcomes to its association all those who are in accord with its declared purposes and who desire to fit themselves by study and otherwise to be the better able to help and teach others. The true theosophist belongs to no cult or sect, yet belongs to each and all. During the pandemic and the constrictions that we have on location and proximity, the Philadelphia United Lodge of Theosophists is a core and associate association of free thinking volunteers who keep three different sessions alive each week. On Wednesday evenings, while our reference library at 1917 Walnut is closed, we continue on with a study of the Bhagavad Gita. And this coming Wednesday night is July 22nd. The title for Wednesday's study in the Gita is The Power of Spiritual Knowledge. You can double check the Gita, pages 31 to 34 and 35 to 37. That meeting will start by Zoom promptly at 7:30 and will continue on until 8:30. On Friday nights, ordinarily there would be a round table and a very informal opening of the library at 1917 Walnut. But through Zoom at 5:15, lasting up to 2 hours, is a session, a round table study. And this coming week, we will be sharing a discussion of B.P. Wadia's article entitled Esoteric or Exoteric, and that can be found in a little book entitled Living the Life. Again, that's an article by B.P. Wadia. And in both cases, Wednesday and Friday, you can look for a Zoom invitation about 24 hours earlier. Next Sunday is the final Sunday in July. It is July 26th. And we will continue on from 11 to 12 in the morning with a Zoom session focused on an article by Robert Crosby, Real Memory, And that can be found in one of two places. You can find it in a small book entitled Universal Theosophy, or you can find it as a portion of a longer book, The Friendly Philosopher. But both are anthologies, if you will, of transcribed talks and letters that Crosby prepared as part of the founding and the maintenance of the early years of the United Lodge of Theosophists. All of these efforts online, and certainly to maintain the structure at 1917, everything is sustained by voluntary efforts, the same as the study of the philosophy itself is fulfilled by individual effort. And that individual effort is determined from within, from one's own higher self, one's own sense of conscience or intuition. But all are welcome, and we appreciate the participation. Now, this morning, we are taking up an article by Robert Crosby. And again, it was delivered but transcribed by someone else. You can find it in Universal Theosophy on page 24. If you're using the larger book, Friendly Philosopher, you can find it on page 234. Try your best if you can, as you refer to different portions of the article, to cite the paragraph number, and that'll help everybody try to figure out where you are and what your comment or your question is. So without further ado, we have a trusty volunteer to deliver the summary of the first five paragraphs of the article entitled, What Reincarnates?
Trusty volunteer. So what reincarnates? That is a big question that many people try to understand. And it is a difficult one, because to understand that there is a permanency that does stand behind all of our reincarnations is a hard one to understand. People are aware, of course, that the body is born and it dies, but our minds have been so identified with the body. And not only the body, but everything around us, which is impermanent, that we are unable to disassociate ourselves from the physical form. Our senses just seem to grab us and hold us in. And some folks think of themselves as the body, and not that there is anything else that is real. But theosophy shows that man is not his body, because the body continues to change, as we all can see from the time we were born until now. And man is not his mind, because from being a teenager and thinking one thing, a few years later, we could be thinking something else. So it is not our mind. But there is a permanency that we can sense that goes from the time that we were children until now, that there is that sense of I that is permanent. And there is no change in this part of our identity. So the identity stays the same. Nothing. So that which is in us that doesn't change, that goes from lifetime to lifetime, is what is known as the real, and it is unchanging. Because nothing that is real changes. And it is only the real that can see and understand these changes. And it is said in this part that change cannot see change because change is the impermanent. It is the unreal. And it is this real portion of us that is eternal and changeless. And this unchanging, constant, and immortal portion of our being is not absent from anything else, whatever. Mr. Crosby goes on to say that there is only one life in the world that we can understand as being permanent. And it is said that the divine self is in all beings, but in some respects it does not shine forth. And it is the real that is within us that we can realize as a human being that this is ourselves. And then it is this source, this one spirit. And the question is, if this is in all beings, why are there so many differences? Why are there so many different forms, personalities, etc.? And it is said that it is only the level of development that makes these changes. And he goes on to talk about the ocean of life and about how we are all droplets in that ocean. And the droplets can be different sizes and whatnot. So we can see that these are this from the same source. And it says that even in the animal kingdom, those species nearest to us are trying to make an attempt to self-consciousness, but we as humans are already self-conscious and we have arrived at that stage. And the last paragraph goes on to say that the power that exists in all of us, that we can see, that this enables us to see that there are beings below us as well as beings above us, and that it is on us as humans and being self-conscious, that it is on us to try and help those beings below us to progress towards self-consciousness. So as he says, we are impelling each one of those lower lives in order to progress. And that if we don't, then we are considered to be injuring those others. So we can help them as well. And that our responsibility to them is to help every being on his way. That all forms, all beings, our individualizations are but aspects of the one spirit. And that is what reincarnates.
Thank you. MDW, you've got your hand up.
Yes. Does it say anywhere in this article how we can become acquainted with this unchanging essence, this drop, this constituent part of the whole, or that which sees change, so it can't be changed? Is there a path to that self-consciousness?
Well, you know, that's very interesting. If we could talk with somebody who has experienced a coma and they've been absent for a series of days or weeks, they will be able to tell you that immediately upon awakening, they had that same sense of I am that they had throughout the fruition of their prior experience. They may not remember the hours or the days or the weeks that they were in the coma state, but they still have that sense of I exist. On a more mundane level, certainly a less threatening level, is the example that we have each day. If we think about passing into the sleep state, spending an evening or a long nap in the deep sleep state, upon awakening, before we take on all the different masks and nuances of the daily personality, the body and the brain, before that is this strong sense of existence and awareness. It may be even without the notion of I am that. It may just be a beingness, existence, in which we begin to sense our surroundings. And then gradually, as mind begins to unfold or to become more enmeshed, if you will, in the environment, physical body and the environment of the room, then we take on additional sheaths or masks of what it is to be. Did anybody else, SL, do you, your hand is up. Follow up?
Yes, to follow up on that, but also we did want to mention a few lines mentioned in paragraph 8. Because
paragraph 8.
It begins with life is one, spirit is one, because we can't have this discussion without recognizing that we are an immortal trinity of Atma, Buddhi, Manas. And Atma being spirit, Buddhi being our accumulated experience and memory, Manas being the thinker, the witness, the observer. And so it is Manas, or the thinker, that incarnates from life to life. And what we call I, or that consciousness of I, is the light of spirit welling up in Manas, which we recognize. It's there in all beings, but because we are mind beings capable of self-awareness, we can identify that I. So we thought it'd be important to clarify that we as observers, as thinkers, are what incarnates from life to life. And we think that's important because there's many people who can't hold on to the idea that they have that permanent identity, but yet they can recognize that they are observers. They're the same observer of everything they go through. Even materialists would have to admit that they've never lost their power to perceive and know and witness throughout their lives.
And that process of perception, the very fact that the strongest materialist who really needs things laid out in a linear kind of fashion, they will say that there is some kind of stable ruler from which they're perceiving. They may note, if they keep a journal or a calendar, passing whims or fancies or passing appetites or opinions, moods, if you will. So all of that can be tracked, but therefore, logically speaking, what does the tracking? A rubber ruler isn't really going to do much in terms of perception and observation, because it's changing and flexing and also a function of manifestation. It's this other spiritual font, and that paragraph 8 is so interesting because it talks about the Trinity. Life is one, spirit is one, consciousness is one. Life, spirit, consciousness, these three form a trinity, and we are that trinity. One truth, three aspects.
CBW. Well, we must begin with the idea of a word called a hint, H-I-N-T. A hint in these sentences and words we hear. And then we move on to the term pointing out the way. So language is a very important part of our grasping with the mind what we have heard. And we must dwell on it continually until one day we say, aha, now I see what that means. So when we use our language, we have to develop skill in pointing out the word way, with also using hints, H-I-N-T. And first thing you know, you could say, well, I'll think about that. Aha, you're on your way. I'll think about what I heard.
Now, what's an interesting aspect of your comment is that the perceiver in creating thought, in sustaining idea, in bringing a container to that language or word or symbol, begins to make the perception process more and more finite, more and more materialistic. So it's true, we have hints in the very language that we use. We can learn about a lot of the constriction in our thought process of the lower mind through the words that we use. That containing is a restriction. The perceiver is beyond and above the use of language, and we have to take great caution that in our study of how we're framing thought and how we're creating ideas and generating energy, we have to take great caution that we're not becoming overly logical, overly fastidious about an intellectual study, but rather are open to using language, symbols, glyphs as a bridge, as a stepping stone to intuition and direct cognition, the perception that has no bounds and has universality. Is there another comment? SL?
Thank you. In paragraph 2, it speaks about the permanency of identity. Could we have some clarification or distinction between what is our personal identity and our individual identity?
What is the difference between personal identity and individual identity? Well, if we can consider it an individual identity, that aspect or thought in which, as perceivers, we're using the base of spirit and universality and eternal verities as a way, a basis of acting and thinking. I'm sorry, I've got a puppy running around here. He escaped. If we can think of that individuality as a permanence, as a higher development of plane, whereas the personality, the personal identification, would be that process by which mind becomes totally engrossed in the functions of the physical, the brain, the body, and the wants and desires that are in the gunas or energy points of the lower, of the transitory, of the lower self. Did you have a different aspect or thought on that? SL?
No, we think you covered it. We just with thinking that in terms of experience, individual identity is that experience of I am, without any qualification. I am that I am. Personal identity is I am thinking of oneself as a certain person with different characteristics, weaknesses, faults, but most especially separate from other personal identities, separate from a life, and consequently acting differently from the basis of our personal identity as opposed to our individual sense of I, which is the same in all.
Mm-hmm. LT, your hand's up.
SL, if I have it right, you make a very good point. It really brings me to think that this I is really, the way I really perceive this out in mind is like a disco ball. Many colors, many facets, and this is where we are. We are that one facet of the many experiencing life in this life or reality. And that's really the I experiencing life from different perspectives. And I think it's what really came to mind is that I have to not so much stay concrete in who I am in this reality. As we are talking about what reincarnates, maybe we can identify ourselves with who we are in this reality or in this lifetime, and instead, you know, be able to stay true to who we are in nature of the I, and be able to take that to the next level as we evolve. Whereas I think, and also in a previous end of the paragraphs of 235, whereas it talks about how we are to evolve or to help evolve other creatures, animals, and so forth, it is the I that ignites us. That way we can experience better in this reality. Maybe, and I think the overall confusion for me may very well be is that I have to identify with something here instead of to realize that there is an I, and that it is I that I am experiencing life in this nature, whereas it may be different in others or in the lower levels of species and animals that we have been at one point, whereas we are to kind of bring them to the next level as we are now. If that makes sense, hopefully.
Okay, yes. So it's important to remember in this philosophy that kaleidoscope of experiences and sensations, the natural cycles and forces in the world go on and on and on. And in our interactions, both with other human beings and our interactions with the animals with whom we reside, or plants or minerals, our interactions throughout, we can choose to be starry-eyed and glazed by the kaleidoscope of what appears to be differentiation and appears to be separate, or we can begin to focus and look from eye to eye to see in the reactions, in the needs, in the desires, in the pain, in the celebrations of others, regardless of the form, to look for commonality, to look for a trace evidence that in this kaleidoscope there's a reflection of that oneness. There is a reflection of principles and everlasting and unchanging force.
Hello?
DK, I think your hand was up. Wait a minute, CBW.
So is it possible to be on this plane incarnated and not have a personal identity that is different or separate from the individuality? And if it is, what does that look like?
Is it possible on this plane to be aware that there's a personality versus the individuality?
No. Is it possible in this plane for an immortal soul to not have an identity as a personality, but just maintains his identity as the individual? And what would that look like while incarnated?
I needed that clarification. Thank you. It is said throughout the ancient teachings that there are beings, I don't want to say superhuman because that has its own connotations, but there are beings above the human state. We currently are experiencing soul moving through a human state, but we can look across cultures, across time periods, in scriptures, in legends, in myths of all kinds, of elder brothers, of great souls, of Mahatmas, saviors. There's all sorts of legends of saviors. There are all sorts of legends of the deific entities far and above the human state who were capable of tremendous, quote, magical or spiritual feats. And there's a whole line of study in the philosophy that very gradually across time, as soul makes greater and greater effort to perfect the use of the human state, to impress all of the substance of the human state, what is actually ongoing is a scenario where the Arjuna of the Gita is gradually raising the self by the self to the Krishna concept, the Christos concept, the Buddha concept of what it is to be spirit in action. And it's a proposition of the philosophy that there are masters, there are those souls who have perfected their use of all compartments of nature. They have supreme knowledge or science, if you will, wisdom on how to use that knowledge. They've perfected the ethical development of motivation and altruism and universal brotherhood and compassion. And they reach a point in their process or evolution where they can continue on assisting the human race and all points of manifestation in a form called Nirmanakaya, which is not necessarily in a physical form as we're aware of it right now, but is centered in what this article points out as a spiritual, a very ethereal form that is eternal. Does that do what you were thinking, TK?
Thank you.
Okay.
CBW,
your turn.
CBW?
Yes, CBW, your turn.
Okay. In the teachings, as we proceed, no matter our materialistic education, which turns out to be a hindrance more than a help because of its technical and unfeeling approach to what's going on around us. So when we hear the terms from the teaching, prostrate thyself before me, we have to take another position. And in that position, we discover our concentration on the materialistic side of speech and everything is a hindrance. So we learn the meaning of gratitude and humility. He who prostrates himself before me. Now that means either lying flat, so to speak, and giving up our self-interest, and then we put it self in quotations, and dedicate ourselves to pointing out the way. And the more we're able to help others, the more we learn. So it is not a technical language approach that we have to consider. Oh yes, our words are important, but we follow the three fundamental propositions laid down, where she says, if you want to understand the secret doctrine, you must grasp these first. So when we keep repeating those to us and consider the meaning of prostrate, then we begin to simplify our approach in words and in actions. So listen, and I repeat the word 1,000,000,000 times, listen. And then we'll be able to say, yes, I have heard that.
Thank you. In the word listen, in the language of prostrate thyself, we find certain nuggets, like with all colloquial expressions, behind certain words, there is a richness, there's a fullness, so that it's not just word calling or word decoding, but rather it's looking into the scripture and in the spirit of the thing. So throughout world religions, we know there is a series of teachings about sublimating the lower and turning within or turning towards something that's higher, to surrender, to submit. There's all different kinds of phrasing to try to express to the mind, to the human mind, the process of using perception and turning that perception in a concentrated, one-pointed, gentle fashion towards certain fundamental truths, toward a one-pointedness that can be shared on behalf of everything in manifestation. So we know, you know, you can think about habit formation. It's one thing to make a negative resolution, I will not do X, Y, Z. Well, certainly we know that human nature and that force of desire and that focus that we've given to the negative begins to be very enticing, can even be overwhelming. But rather to surrender, to note, I've got this particular habit. What's the flip side of that habit? And then to creatively begin to consider other uses of the habit, maybe a nuance of the habit, maybe a substitution of another habit. What happens in that process? We surrender the original deer folding of the habit and gradually transmute it and uplift it so that the same forces, the same energies, the same tendencies are now supporting perception and service in a new, more constructive manner. We've extinguished the first and surrendered it. We've energized and transmuted to a new format. SL.
I'd like to return to LT's contribution about the almost necessity to have something in this life to anchor to in terms of identity. And we think a key to that lies in the second paragraph where it talks about reality. Reality being that which does not change, only the real that endures and is unchanged. Only the real can be that which is endures and unchanging. Well, from the viewpoint of the very highest metaphysics, that's true. But theosophy recognizes, and HPB has mentioned in the Secret Doctrine, that for any individual thinker, that which they're going through seems real and is real for them. It is real as they are. And as we evolve, what we at one point thought was real is no longer real or truth to us. That evolution itself is a progression of awakenings into what is truth and what is real. But in each particular stage, that which we see of our personalities, that which we see of our experience on this plane, is a reality to us that we have to work in.
It is the reality. And when we find ourselves moving through the day and find ourselves totally enmeshed in reality, so we've completely identified with a problem or some sort of inflammation at work or in the home or some kind of real inner drive to get something accomplished, it sometimes helps to create an anchor, a few symbols or a word or an image that can bring us back from being totally immersed in the experience of the plane, and in the moment can calm and center us again. Some people use, you know, an image of a symbol. Other folks use a small phrase. Some folks use, you know, a particular notion of how they're going to color the day. However it works, that anchoring process, even in the midst of a great storm, a tremendous jubilation or celebration, can bring us back to a very serene, very sane, very centered place. MDW, and then TK.
Yes. So where does meditation take us? Where does that concentration, where does that take us? Does that take us to the real? Or is that still not reality?
Is where we go with meditation the real or still transitory? Well, you know, in so many ways, as finite minds working on this plane through a particular physical brain and the neurological synapses of that brain and the environment of the body, etc., we do the best we can in the culture of concentration to sit periodically at the beginning of the day, the end of the day, to reflect and to contemplate and to consider the fundamental propositions and how they work throughout the day. Many of us try 24/7 periodically to reground ourselves in a form of meditation to bring our mind back so that the anchor becomes the spiritual rather than the external. In weekly meetings, as we share right now, we meditate together in a different way. But in each of those aspects, we make the effort while conscious, while using physicality, to hearken back to the source as best we can. But that's still not the deep reality of the kind of state of consciousness that we achieve, that a very highly evolved soul can achieve at will sitting in meditation, but that most of us can achieve in deep sleep states where there is that oneness with the collectivity, the oneness with the universality, and oneness of perception in which all of the physical attributes, the psychic attributes, all of the emotionality drops away. But where we are right now in our effort to meditate would be little stepping stones, like a child beginning to learn his or her numbers or letters. They're nowhere near reading tremendous volumes of fine literature. They're just dabbling. And for many, many of us, that practice of concentration and meditation is the beginning of the effort. TK, your hand was up.
Well, since we're talking about the individuality, and we've talked in previous weeks, we think it was just last week about the, it seemed it was talking about the process of individualization of the lower kingdoms. And the higher they are, kind of the more individual. To read that, it almost seems that the individuality therefore grows out of this process in the lower kingdoms. Seems like a conflict, because that's all. Go ahead.
Okay, but this article is marvelous in that aspect, in that there are phrases throughout the article that the ancients said that the divine self is in all beings but does not shine forth. It is the real within. That's paragraph 3. And then we, in paragraph 5, are introduced to the notion that humanity is now building the bridge of thought, and that we stand as gods to lower kingdoms. The philosophy states that spirit, the absolute, is the source of all. The beingness that is beyond, inclusive, and all-encompassing is without attributes. And that gradually, in an evolution, in the true sense of the full word of evolution, spirit, soul, mind comes forth from that. And it is said that those souls in the human state, that self-conscious thinker, is from the very beginning and stands above and throughout all manifestations. So in different periods of time, that eternal may assume different physical forms, but that eternal comes first. And those physical forms are used in various rounds and races, it is said, for particular gains in experience, in knowledge, in wisdom, in service to the whole. So whereas the human state is, and we're using these particular forms right now, in another round, another race, the form may change, but the eternal perceiver, the ray, the absolute, will remain absolutely the same. In paragraph 4, there's a very interesting statement. It says, in the animal kingdom, those species that are nearest to us make an approach to self-consciousness. So there's a couple of different ways to interpret that, isn't there? The species closest to us, the great apes, are an interesting study in this philosophy, and there's a lot that you can look up and consider and check out for yourself about something called the delayed race and how there is a quasi-self-consciousness in the great apes because of what has happened during past cycles of incarnations and rounds and races. But there's another point also as a companion to a very recently acquired puppy. Those species that are closest to us take on an impress from us. It may be a companion animal in the home. It certainly can be a plant in the home or in the garden. We impress all of these forms, and those that come the closest to us in our waking hours gain the greatest impress. So there's two different avenues for that line of thought. Follow up, TK?
If I may.
Please.
So then when we talk about the process of evolution and the process of further and further individualization, moving toward that, it seems then, and words are sometimes words are hard to deal with. So yeah. Then could we say that this process of individualization that the form takes is more a process of the perfection of a form so that it is ready to be the vehicle of an individual? Not that the vehicle becomes the individual, but right. It's perfected so that the incarnation can happen.
Exactly. So the same way that the sun shines and the sun rays are emanating, they may pass through, I want to say blockages. The sun's rays may be blocked by screens or trees or cloud structure. It may be blocked by sunscreen. There's a number of different ways that those rays may or may not equally treat every point on the planet. It doesn't mean that the sun's rays have become the shade or the sun's rays have disappeared on a cloudy day. It just means that the radiation, the emanation of force, of energy, of essence, of perception in us is there. And then depending on the conditioning, depending on the constriction of the manifestation, that perfected form that's perfect for the bee means that a degree of intelligence can be expressed on this planet in a manner that's mind-boggling. The bee should not be able to fly on our planet, and yet it does. So that each of the forms in their own finite way is the perfect tool for development of soul in that particular moment of development. MJW.
Uh-oh, yes, here I am, pushing all these buttons here. If I may say something about meditation again.
Oh.
We talk about meditation and concentration. We also speak about the lifetime meditation, but we think that the lifetime's meditation over lives, many life after life after life, is addressed in the last paragraph, which is just a wonderful paragraph because it really ties everything together. It helps us to see our purpose, and you know that we really do have a purpose here. We struggle and sometimes think we're not making progress. Then we're told, don't think about your progress, because that's one way not to progress. But it's the task of raising up all of humanity. So we incarnate, we love this, we incarnate from age to age for the preservation of the just, the destruction of the wicked, and the establishment of righteousness. And if I just may mention, you know, the passing of John Lewis was definitely an example of that. Not being political, just a great person who really struggled and for righteousness.
Oh, and the fact that we can perceive, that we know intrinsically from conscience righteousness. We have within us this impress of altruism and justice and compassion and selflessness. Each of us walks a path where at some level we know that. By the same token, those seeds of wickedness, of injustice, of animosity, of separateness, any seed of so-called evil we may perceive, there's no use focusing, name-calling, separating ourselves and saying, oh, you know what, you know, I'm more righteous, et cetera, et cetera. But in certain incarnations, and certainly the late Representative Lewis is a prime example of one who came into this particular plane facing challenges in life that many of us, if not most of us, would have considered daunting, and then rising to that internal voice of the conscience, rising to a point of service where the sense of personality, of selfishness is diminished, and instead tremendous force is brought to bloom seeds of kindly service, of courageous service, of tremendous valor. That last paragraph, it's actually paragraph 11. It's the very last one. The task is the raising up of the whole of humanity to the highest possible stage of perfection on an earth of this kind. We have to bring ourselves in touch and tune with the whole great purpose of nature, which is the evolution of soul, and for which alone all the universe exists. So while we may from time to time become a little downtrodden or frustrated or concerned, even Arjuna became despondent for a very strong sense of emotionality. We can hold on to this last paragraph that wherever we find ourselves, that's where we're planted, that's where we're going to bloom, as long as we don't keep pulling ourselves up by the roots and battering ourselves over the head in a negative kind of fashion. That would be personal. That would be destructive. That would be a use of perception that really does not benefit the collectivity. CBW, you've been trying to make a point.
Well, the lesson is what reincarnates? And a word came to our mind immediately. Simplicity. Well, now, it said that, but I have to do research. And it is our study, comparison of notes, listening to other companions as they repeat their ideas. What reincarnates? Simplicity. Can we describe that?
Simplicity. If we think of the serene, sane simplicity of rising in the morning, setting a tone for the day, being at one as a tone for the day, of setting our sights to come what may as the day unfolds, to remain as uplifting and as positive and as centered as we can, and then hearkening back to that as an anchor throughout the course of the day, whatever comes, detaching from the results of actions as best we can, and then closing the day with a session, a very simple session, again, of pondering, if you will, pondering, how did the day go? Did I remain at one? Was the perceiver on top of listening, hearkening, making the effort to bring peace and serenity, to bring new energy or new vibrance to all points of time and to all degrees of manifestation? That is a very simple way to live. And you know, what we have not talked about in this article is the word sublimate or sublime. In a couple of places, Crosby uses the words sublimate. And really, that simply is what life is all about, to divert or to modify an instinctual impulse into something higher, something that is more collective, that is spiritual, that is one for all. And that process, even in the chemical world, can be extremely simple, because sublimation can happen in your ice cube tray in the freezer. When you pour water in, the water constricts and there's a particular loss. There's no intermediate stages. There's no tremendous effort of transition, but rather it's this immediate process, almost a direct cognition as best the mineral water can do. Well, it is 12 o'clock and we've come to the end of the hour. But please, you know, consider the article as the week goes on. It's a remarkable article. And after all these years, frankly, my article is so underlined that every other sentence is super, super important. Enjoy the week, and I hope to see you Zooming in on Wednesday at 7:30 for a Gita class. Take care.
Bye, all.
Bye.
Bye. Bye.